Welcome to the Metal Zone Podcast, episode 19 from Monday, July 29th, 2019. That is hard to say. I'm Tom.
And I'm Stefan. And on this week's episode, well, I have a rant topic about maybe planned obsolescence. I had actually a part of one of the appliances I have at home fail twice by the same mode always after 2 years of using it. We'll also take a little bit, or we take a look behind the curtains of YouTube and talk a little bit about A-B testing with TubeBuddy that we use to, change our thumbnails regularly and see if, they are more engaging to you, our viewers.
Yeah, and Stefan, for you, that's been working out because you will receive your silver play button shortly.
Yes.
Tomorrow. So by the time you're listening to this, it will be in your hands. Tweeted. Good man, I want to see. For the news this week, we have one big topic, Curvy Slicer. Again, stirring up some hype for non-planar slicing for FDM, where your layers don't line up with the XY plane, but they're curved and morphed and all weird and stuff. So we kind of talk about, if that's actually practical or if it's going to end at the academic research level, which it has so many times before. And for the topic of the week, we kind of discuss like where 3D printing should be used, is used by us, what we actually use it for, and we get philosophical there, as we tend to do.
Yeah. At last, we will answer a couple of questions regarding metal FDM, so printing parts with a metal infused 3D printing filament that you need to sinter afterwards. We answer a question about, putting specific settings into your decode for different features of your print in order to maybe increase the strength of them. And then at last, we talk a little bit about the SolidWorks Maker license and if this is an option in comparison to the free Fusion 360 license that many of us are using.
Gosh, Stefan, why are we so tired today, man?
Yeah, well, you had been streaming yesterday. I had been in the mountains over the weekend with a couple of friends, and I didn't catch that much sleep as regularly. And it's actually the first time we do the podcast recording in the morning. It's pretty unusual for us.
We started talking at 10 a.m. Yeah, I just had breakfast and went right to preparing for the podcast.
Yeah, it's been a rough weekend for me. I'm quite happy that I don't have to work today. But on the other hand, I hope this podcast recording will get me in line today so that I will be able to finish some work and finish the next video for the coming weekend.
Yeah, it's the Meltzone Molten Edition today.
Both our brains are molten.
Yeah.
But you've been streaming pretty long yesterday, so you ended up, well, at least in like German time, you ended
My time.
Your time. Well, your time is flexible. Since you're self-employed, you can set your clock to like how you want to have it.
Yeah, I run on US time, it feels like. Yeah, but I've been streaming till 11 p.m. Good stuff. Fun printer, actually better than I expected, except for that part where the retention screw was missing in the bed or in the build plate assembly, and I loosened those clamping screws, and the entire thing just went and smashed into the FEP and into the LCD screen. Thankfully, nothing broke, but like that is a pretty major oversight on Elegoo's part. But yeah.
Was it just a quality control problem that they missed the screw, or was it something different?
Yeah, that's what I think. The screw just was not in there.
Yeah, that kind of sucks. But was this the first time you used your new streaming equipment? So your x4 HDMI 4K.
people were commenting on that. They're like, dude, how many cameras do you have? It's four cameras. It's four 4K cameras. I may have used it like once in a YouTube stream before, but I did use it for the patron exclusive hangouts or YouTube supporters as well. I did use it for that quite a bit, but I think I got that around like New Year's and just didn't have the mindset to or the time to stream since then, it feels like.
But in regards of that equipment, were you happy with your investment in that direction?
Yeah, I gotta say, I've never had a stream that from the technical side was as flawless as yesterday's. The only thing that happened is that the B cam, so the camera that is camera right. Mm-hmm. So the one that I have the zoom lens on ran out of battery, but it was plugged into one of the USB ports on my screens. I think that USB port just decided, okay, I'm done supplying current. so I had to give that a quick battery. But other than that, like absolutely flawless, except for those 4 hours that I had to spend to actually get the Windows system to the computer to do what I wanted to do, which was to start OBS Studio without it immediately crashing. And in the end, running the Windows 1903 update fixed that. Apparently, that shuffled enough things around to get him back into place.
Yeah. Well, I haven't...
But yeah, fun stream.
Yeah, I also haven't been streaming for quite a while. I hope that... Or my silver YouTube play button is scheduled to arrive tomorrow, and I'm thinking about doing like a Q&A stream at the weekend.
Do live unboxing.
Live unboxing, yeah. Oh,
People love those.
Yeah. I don't really know if I can be that patient to wait with unpacking my super reward for the next couple of days. But yeah, I'm really thinking about doing like a short Q&A stream at the weekend, unboxing my play button, just saying hello and thank you to all of the guys who had been around for the last couple of 2 years or 2.5 years, actually. And yeah, we'll see. And I haven't been opening OBS since that, and I usually have issues with it as well.
Yeah, but OBS is great. Let's put it like that. OBS is a fantastic piece of software. It's just it's so complex. There's so many things playing into it, and hardware usually is the one that's causing the issues with drivers and all that. But yeah, Q&A streams, pretty good content. I mean, some of my most popular streams so far were just, hey, let me debug your prints. Mm-hmm. The 3D Senpai streams, people love those.
Yeah. But you haven't been doing 3D Senpai for quite a while.
Yeah, I feel like it's you know, you do it twice and it's like, you know, you've covered most of the things that people are writing in about. You're just repeating yourself.
Yeah, but I think that's fine because you always have new like watchers and watchers of your videos. And even though they still might have the same problems, I think in the end still everybody can learn from it.
Yeah, possibly. And doing like recurring content. That's also something that I've been like struggling with as far as just video topics go. Regular video topics is if I see someone else do a topic, for example, like what, you know, all your strength testing, like, hey, you know, what is the best info? What is the best way of smoothing or not smoothing your parts? That does it actually make it strong? I'm like, okay, well, there goes that topic. It's done. It's been covered. But, you know, my reference is always the tech space, like Linus Tech Tips, J's Two Cents, Gamers Nexus, that entire environment. And I'm like, okay, you know, these guys did an RTX 2080 review. They did it. It's like, okay, it's the same review, but it's different perspectives. So that there's always value added. So I'm thinking like, it's the same idea for 3D printing where... Yeah. You know, if you redo a test and you validate it and you confirm the results, that's also a good finding versus, you know, having a result that disagrees because you did some things differently.
Yeah, and you have different approaches, different types of audiences. So the more techie ones, the more casual ones. And if you like create the video in a different way with a different audience in mind, it might actually benefit even more, even though the topic is covered twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That's been that. We will be testing, talking about more YouTube audience stuff in a second. But first, let's jump into projects. You've got a rant coming up, I hear.
I have a rant coming up. I don't know if you can see my the picture or my face or the part I'm holding in my hands at the moment. To all of the viewers, this is what I have in hand. This is actually the rotor, so please correct me there, the rotor anchor of a brushless motor. So it's...
Is the anchor all... I thought anchor was just a brushed center rotor thing.
Okay, so it's...
Whatever.
It's so, the rotor of a motor of my laundry dryer. And it's missing a couple of magnets.
Yeah, so what we're seeing here for the audio listeners is we have a shaft, two bearings on the ends, next to a rotor, and there's like eight longish magnets, and one of them is split down the middle and missing half of it. So I'm guessing that's one of the poles of the magnet that now just is non-existent anymore.
Yes, and so yeah, I have been telling you guys before that I have been, well, away over the weekend, and we got back home and we had some laundry to do, and I was working in the basement. I was doing some 3D scanning work, and at some point I noticed a really strange voice or noise coming out of the other room.
Oh god, and
a strange
voice coming out of the other
room. I went into the room where my laundry dryer and the washing machine is, and I noticed that the laundry dryer again is like doing screaming noises, and there's kind of a backstory behind that. So we moved into that house 4 years ago and bought a new, well, washing machine and a laundry dryer. And 2 years, exactly, more or less exactly 2 years after we bought the laundry dryer, I had exactly the same problem. So the motor was stalling, nothing wasn't working anymore. The nice thing here in Germany is that you have usually 2 years of warranty on your parts. So a technician from AEG came in and replaced the motor in the end. And he told me, yeah, it's kind of weird, but some magnets of your motor came loose. And that caused the motor to stall and wasn't working anymore. And he put in a new motor and everything was working fine for exactly 2 more years. And then yesterday, the same thing happened again. New motor. I took it apart yesterday, and again, a couple of magnets came loose. So these magnets are glued to the rotor with some, I don't know, epoxy adhesive. And yeah, they fell apart and kind of ruined my washer. And I'm kind of pissed in that direction, because at that point when we got the replacement motor, that dryer was already out or has been released 3 years before. So I think there had been a couple of, well, events before where some others had their motors failing, but they didn't seem to, well, improve the motor in the first place. And yeah, I don't know. So what I'm asking myself right now, is it like planned obsolescence? So after the 2 years of warranty, the part just fails and you are kind of forced to buy a new one? Or is it just bad design and they didn't improve on the design because, yeah, they didn't care? I don't know.
It may really just be a really cheap part. So yeah, we still should talk about planned obsolescence, because that is a huge topic. But I just looked up AEG. So, you know, AEG is one of those brands that you're, you know, used to hearing. Okay, it's an old German brand. I just looked it up. They were founded in 1883 in Berlin. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of other brands. Like, what is it? Telefunken is the other one. And there are some, like, record player brands and all those that now are nothing but a sub-licensed brand, where essentially where it's not the actual company producing it anymore, but they are just licensing the name to other companies to use it. So the same with AEG. So your AEG dryer is not a German product, as in, you know, it's made by a German company. It's somewhere, I don't know, China, Taiwan, Philippines, some company making just a white label product and putting the AEG brand on it. And it can be whatever, essentially, for parts. So I'm thinking that's one of the reasons there, that it's just really just a cheap product. And it's the same with all the other, like, record. Again, I don't know what the actual company was. It's on the tip of my tongue. Those companies that you think are like old German brands are just you know, your TCL products. Mm. Maybe TCL is even a better product at this point than what they are.
Well, still the thing is, AEG is not a totally cheap brand. It's not like the Miele standard we also often buy here in Germany. It's not an inexpensive product, and I'm just pissed that this happened. This happened twice. And, well, I won't be throwing the dryer away. I contacted AEG yesterday and hope maybe then they can supply a new motor. I actually, or for free, hopefully. I already bought a new motor yesterday, but that's still a 90 euros investment just to get the motor shipped. Then I have to put it back into the machine.
Yeah. I mean, your time is probably worth more than buying a new dryer.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, so, I mean, warranty, what we have here in Germany is, you know, that there's Gewährleistung and Garantie. And those, I think those both translate to warranty, but Garantie is what the manufacturer gives you and says, okay, I vouch for my product for this amount of time. And Gewährleistung is actually what basically legislation is making them do, is like, okay, within the first year, like if it fails, it is assumed that it was an issue that was there when it shipped. And then the next year is basically you have to prove that issue was already there when it was shipped, as in, you know, you didn't swap out the motor for a subpar one. But like those 2 years are usually where you get stuff replaced. So where planned obsolescence comes into play is like, you know, manufacturers tend to engineer their product lifetimes for, you know, 2.5 years. So when it fails, they don't have to replace it because it's out of warranty. But it still incentivizes the user to buy new stuff, essentially, if that's what it's about, right?
It's probably good for our economy, but it's for the consumer, it's just bad. It's really bad.
There is the right to repair movement. Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar to that.
Yeah.
Essentially pushing manufacturers to, trying to force manufacturers to provide replacement parts and to provide replacement manuals. And I think California is actually one of the states where that has been making real good progress. Mm. But our German government's position is right now, they'd rather have a circular economy, as in you recycle stuff and you produce new goods and you sell those again, versus repairing stuff. So it's something that fuels the economy, man. Like you gotta think about that.
Yeah. Well, in the past, you had your dryer in the washing machine for 20 years.
Yeah, but nobody was buying new stuff. Whenever you bring up planned obsolescence, Strumpfhosen, what the pantyhose? That's always what comes up. There used to be a pantyhose manufacturer that was so good that had never, you know, pantyhose, you know, you get the Laufmaschen. One of the loops opens up and you get that long, you know, essentially one row missing. One of the manufacturers was so good, they produced pantyhose that never failed, that didn't rip, that didn't have a failure mode. They went out of business because they stopped selling them because everyone just had one that lasted. So they eventually, you know, toned down their quality, you know, made the material thinner, whatever. So they would essentially fail. Mm-hmm. Same with incandescent light bulbs. You know, you have your 1,000-hour lifetime and that's what you get. And then you buy a new one. Of course, there's also like efficiency that plays into that. That's a bit deeper. But that's just how the economy works, man. If you have something that lasts forever, like nobody's ever going to buy new stuff.
Yeah. You're probably right there. The thing that was bothering me yesterday is that I can remember that they advertised the dryer and the washing machine I bought at that time, that they have really good long-lasting motors in there, which are brushless, because usually with normal brushed motors, the failure mode of the motors is that the brushes just wear out and you need to replace them. With the brushless motors, nowadays find in more or less every machine, you don't have that issue anymore. There aren't any parts wearing out anymore besides like the bearings and things like these. But no, yeah magnets are releasing from the rotor. Oh, come on.
I mean,
I was really tempted to rant on Twitter yesterday about that, but I was actually held back by my better half. And, well, she said that talk to them at first, see what they are answering, and don't kind of abuse your influence.
Also rant tweets never get much exposure anyways.
Yeah. Most of the time. It was just horrible. I was tired yesterday and that thing wasn't working and I took everything apart and then I see exactly the same thing failing again. Yeah, we'll see how it will turn out.
Yeah, I guess one closing thought on that. Yeah, circular economy is great and all for, you know, keeping the economy pumping, but it may not be that great for the planet and for the future of our species, but yep. I mean, you know, the people in charge don't really think that long term. So yeah, we're kind of there. Yep. There goes the explicit tech.
Goodbye, advertising money.
Oh, actually, let me put a marker here so I can censor that out. You guys know what I said.
Yeah.
I do have two more notes in here for the planned obsolescence. Because it did come up recently in discussions about, okay, why does, for example, Fusion 360 have the simulation all as a cloud service? And some people pointed out, okay, that's just so they can remove or add features whenever they feel like it. So with everything running on Autodesk's cloud service for simulation, like if they say, okay, I'm not giving like the maker license, that simulation feature anymore, they can just click a button, they can disable it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if people have a software that actually runs on their computer, that's a bit harder to do. So that's something. And
they can constantly charge people. So I think you said in your video that the amount of credits you would have needed to do these optimizations was like $100.
Probably, yeah. Because every simulation is $5, essentially, every run.
Yeah. So that's recurring income for them. And there are a couple of software companies around, Simplify3D, for example, who notice that if they are not using this subscription-based service, well, where the license is more or less on the cloud, they have revenue in the first place, but after a couple of months and years, this revenue stream just dries out. And having cloud services just, needs you to pay each month, even though you don't earn a lot in the first place, it's, well, in the long run, better.
Yeah. Here's a crazy idea. Why don't you just have like a dryer rental service or something like that, where you don't own it, but you pay for it every month and you get replacement parts. Actually, I think that's pretty common in the US, where you own your house, but you have like a rental service for appliances like fridge, dryer, washing machine, dishwasher, all that. That is just on a service agreement and on a rental basis. So you always have someone on call if something fails, but you never own your appliance. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Maybe that's something that's coming our way as well.
A pretty interesting idea. I don't know if it's totally against the like German way of life.
yeah, for sure. But we're seeing that shift anyways, where you don't own your car, you don't own your house, you don't own whatever, you don't own your phone because it's on a 24 month lease or whatever financing with your with your contract. We're getting there
definitely. On other projects, we both, that's probably a topic which is a bit behind the curtains of YouTube, which might not be interesting for everyone, but I think that's something really interesting and which we both have been using for the last couple of months and weeks. So there is, how should I start that?
The algorithm.
So we get our views by making people click on our videos. And people are kind of driven towards clicking on videos with good thumbnails and good titles in the first place. And in the earlier days, people were kind of judged by being good or bad, or, well, not really judged by being good or bad, but more or less being paid by how many clicks their videos got. And there were some controversies in that direction. Nowadays, it's more view time. But anyways, that's just something on the side. So what we both are doing, we are thinking about how should we really like kind of put a title on our videos that it's interesting for people to watch it. How, what kind of thumbnails are we using to just get the attention of the viewers or get the attention of you guys who are browsing through the whole video stream that you are bombarded with every day? And yeah. So the thing is, there is a metric now in YouTube, which is called click-through rate. So every time you see any thumbnail appearing on your more or less YouTube video stream, this is an impression. So you have kind of seen it, or it was, well, presented on your screen. And the click-through rate basically means how many times have people actually clicked on your video when they were able to see it. And click-through rate, for my videos, it's around 4%. So if I am posting a video and it is shown to other people, in general, 4% of the people are clicking on the thumbnail and then watching the video. And the thing is, where also this optimization tool comes in, the question is, if I change my thumbnail to something, I don't know, again, the bad word, clickbaity comes in there.
Engaging.
A more engaging thumbnail. Does this click-through rate change or, well, increase, basically, which is, yeah, beneficial for my channel. And YouTube is now able to give us this metric and we can play around with it manually. But there is a tool called TubeBuddy. Which is also a subscription service, a pretty expensive subscription service. Oh, yeah. It's $50 a month, where there is a tool integrated in the background where you can set two different thumbnails and TubeBuddy will change the thumbnail every day. And then after this day, kind of gather the metrics of the video. So how good was the click-through rate? And then help you to optimize your thumbnails. And this has been working kind of well for you. And also, yeah. I have been doing it for quite a bit over the last couple of, well, weeks and months. So
yeah. But before we move on here, let me add one more thing to CTR, to click-through rate. Yes, the YouTube algorithm is really sensitive to how long viewers stick through your videos. If they stop watching after 10 seconds, then your video will get demoted. If they watch the entire thing, it will be shown to more potential viewers. But that is all post-CTR, people seeing the thumbnail and the title. What click-through rate is basically based on is people not knowing anything about the video other than seeing the title and the thumbnail. And that basically tells you, okay, are people deciding to watch my video versus someone else's video just based on the thumbnail and title? So that is a very good metric that lets us see, okay, this thumbnail and this title is engaging to the people that are looking for something to watch. Mm-hmm. It may not work as great for truly educational and guide content, mm-hmm. like if it's how to set up the TMC2209 drivers for this and this. Like people are going to look for that specifically, mm-hmm. but if they're just browsing through and if they're looking for something to watch, then CTR tells you, okay, are they choosing to watch my stuff or others? Again, based just on the title and just on the thumbnail. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like you said, we've been doing some A/B testing, and what TubeBuddy, this subscription service, by the way, if you're paying $50 a month, you're getting ripped off. check the description there, discount codes down there. Usually it's 25 to 50% that you can easily get off of that service. What TubeBuddy lets us do is do A/B testing, as in one day the video is automatically going to have one thumbnail, and the other day it's automatically going to have another thumbnail. And it's not just us doing that. I've been noticing that from other channels as well. Veritasium is definitely doing that. And he's been pointing out, okay, I've been doing this on, for example, the Shade Balls videos, where it's been one thumbnail where it's a bit of a wider angle, him kind of just poking his head out of the Shade Balls, the other one where it's like a close-up with the same thing. Everyone's experimenting with that because it's a really good way to optimize your views, how many people watch your stuff without actually having to produce more content. If we can get people to watch the videos we've already made, if we can get that in front of more eyes, then yeah, that's a really good way for us to improve the value that the videos we've already produced have to people. That doesn't mean that we don't have to produce more stuff and that we don't want to produce more stuff, but you know, it's work we've already put in. And now it's being put to work. So yeah, on the topology optimization shelf brackets, I think just having that not just having the A-B testing, because A-B testing essentially is intended to tell you, okay, this one did better than that one. But just having that flipping thumbnail, because as I've noticed, like the promotion period for YouTube is 2 days essentially, where people get shown a new video as, hey, this is new, by the way, where it's getting more actively promoted. So day one, it's the original thumbnail. Day two, it's the alternative one. And, you know, it gets shown to the same people. If the first thumbnail didn't engage them, then maybe the second one did. So that's already a massive, massive, well, advantage there. It is extra work to create two thumbnails. A thumbnail is like, you know, 15 to 30 minutes of work at least, if you want to create a nice one.
But in comparison to the rest of the video, that's kind of nothing. And sometimes these, or most often these thumbnails make a video go kind of viral or do better or worse. So it's a really value time spent on creating those. I usually do 2, 3, 4, or 5 thumbnails for each video. And in the past, I just haven't taken a look at all of them and then chose the one that looked the most engaging for me.
Yeah.
And now it's doing exactly, well, now this has been done automatically, and I really know what is the difference, and I kind of learn what is more engaging for the viewers in the long run. And the interesting thing was, so I had two interesting occasions or two interesting videos where the outcome wasn't as I have been expecting. So one was the, what is the best layer hide? So the video was doing kind of well over the first week and something like that, but then it kind of just died down. And then I checked just the overall click-through rates of all of my videos, and I have seen that this was like in the lower 3% range. And I thought, yeah, maybe just give that a try. So the first thumbnail I used was kind of artistic. So I had a nice shot with lots of bokeh in the background and just a little bit of text on there. I really liked the thumbnail itself because it looked nice. It looked professional. And then I thought, okay, let's now just make something really cheap. Two parts with different layer heights and just a green text on there, which is the best layer height or something like that. My click-through rate jumped from 3.something% to 8%.
And that was not with A-B testing. That was just replacing it.
That was with A-B testing, okay. Because I did not know how it would really go, but the difference was huge there. So I noticed
Trump meme here.
I noticed that it is often good to not really do artistic images which look nice, but just simple ones with simple texts on them, which kind of stand out a little bit from all of the other ones which are in the channel. And this kind of led to the point that the video is now getting like 3, 4, 5 times more views, because with the new thumbnail, the views started to rise again. And this also causes YouTube to recommend the video more often. And this was really interesting. Yeah. This was really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of a self-amplifying system in the YouTube algorithm there.
And the second thing I had, this was the video where I reprinted the gear for my salad spinner, and where the first thumbnail was this kind of creepy face in the front with me holding like the gearbox of the salad spinner. And kind of a lot of people have been commenting that they find the image of me kind of creepy, but the click-through rate was really
Linus Tech Tips thumbnail, yeah, essentially
something like that. And the click-through rate was really good, which was I thought, okay, so yeah, maybe do something like that again later, because people are engaged by that. Even though they find it creepy, they kind of still click on the thumbnail. But then I still did an A-B testing, and I just added a really simple picture with 3D printed gears on that. The click-through rate wasn't that good, but the viewer retention was way higher. So viewer retention means what amount of time are people watching a video of you? So,
and essentially what that reflects is, are the people getting what they expected?
Exactly.
That's what that metric tells you, essentially. Yeah. Yeah.
So the click-through rate wasn't that good, but people were watching the video way longer, which tells me that before, many people had been clicking on the video that weren't really into 3D printing and Fusion 360 and things like these, and they just changed to the next video right after the start. So even though I got more views, the watch time was worse, and YouTube is kind of rewarding watch time. Yep. So changing the thumbnail for me, I had a little bit less views, but way more watch time. So also more like ad revenue, and YouTube was promoting it more, even though the views were worse. So this was also really interesting for me to see how you need to craft your thumbnails that they also engage the people who are interested in the stuff you're doing. And things what we both are doing kind of often are bit more technical topics, and you don't want people to just click on the video and then switch to the next one after a couple of seconds because they just don't understand or are not interested in what you're doing. But there is kind of a big group of people around there who are interested in that kind of topics, and you need to make your thumbnails and make your titles engaging in a way that those click on it. And it's maybe not as clickbaity as it was before, but the
audience matches up to what you want them to be. One thing I'm thinking is a big part for viewer retention, essentially, is, or not for viewer retention, just for click-through rate, is where is your thumbnail on the professionality scale? Like, is it just a really quickly thrown together thing? Or is it like a highly produced bokeh, like you mentioned, nice colors, nice everything? I think if viewers think, okay, this is like some advertising, overproduced, whatever show thing, that's not what they're coming to YouTube for. On the other hand, if it's just, maybe if it's just a guy with a webcam talking through stuff, that may be more in line with what they're expecting. I'm thinking about Project Farm right now.
Yeah.
His videos have been taking off really well. And it's like production value is like super low on the stuff he's doing. Content is good, but it's not overproduced in the slightest bit. And apparently that's what resonates with just YouTube. It's authentic, right? Yeah. and thumbnails should reflect that. So A/B testing is a really great tool for this. You mentioned that you heard that YouTube may actually provide something like that in the future at some point, once they fix all the crap that's happening with YouTube Studio, the new one. Yeah. Like,
so currently the click-through rate is only shown by day, but YouTube will be, they have already a tool in beta testing, which will give you the click-through rate like in every minute. Just like you see the views, you also see directly the click-through rate, so that you can try to optimize your thumbnails with even more iterations in a short period of time.
So we can do like hourly thumbnail swaps.
Hourly thumbnail swaps.
Every 15 minutes.
But it should actually... But there is kind of a problem in this direction, because this shouldn't lead to creators optimizing their thumbnails in a way that they are over clickbaity. So I don't know if it's a good thing that this will come out. I like data. I would really like to see what difference, maybe only some little things, do on click-through rate and other things. But as I said, it could also lead into the direction that people are just optimizing their thumbnails to be overly clickbaity.
Yeah, just the little things. Oh yeah, just add a red arrow right there. Just a little one. Yeah. But yeah, in general, TubeBuddy, you mentioned you did it for batch replaces. Mm. I also used it for that. I had like a 1 month subscription at one point, and then paused for a while. And now I have a demo subscription again. I'm probably going to move to just an annual one, because there's so much stuff that it can do. Link in the description if you want to try it out for yourself. It is expensive, yes. For us at our scale, I think it totally makes sense to have just that extra bit of that edge, right?
So there are also a couple of other YouTube creators, I think, watching or listening to the podcast. It's I think I pay now €33 a month.
Yeah, that's with a 25% discount.
Yeah, it's really, really expensive. But the thing, maybe just try it out for a month. Check.
They have free trials.
Oh, they have free trials. So yeah, that's also pretty good. Take a look at the overall click-through rate of all of your videos. You can do that in YouTube Studio Beta. And maybe try the A-B testing out with some of the videos that are underperforming. And see if that helps you.
Sort by CTR.
Yeah. So you always need this lever effect. Why should I pay $33 a month if I don't get like $33 of views or advertising money more with that?
Yeah.
So I think it's worth for me, and I really like to take a look at the data. And as I said, I used the batch replacement in the past quite a bit, which also just tremendously helps me out, even with just 100 videos that are on my channel. But there are some pretty cool things there, which you can just try out. There's even a free version that I had been using in the past for like years.
Yeah, doesn't have any of the cool features like A/B testing or battery place, but it does show like some more infos about the videos you're watching on YouTube, like the tags they're using, search rankings, all that. But yeah, okay, enough with the non-sponsored advertising TubeBuddy here. I wish there was more competition on that market.
Yeah.
Like it's like they are really the only ones who are doing this this well, and even like this well is kind of an overstatement. Like it's a pretty janky tool at times.
Yeah.
All right, your silver play button will arrive.
Yeah, I talked about that.
As in,
as in physically. Have we talked about that before?
Did we already cover it?
We already covered it.
Okay, whatever.
The Melted Brain podcast. Yeah, it is scheduled with UPS to arrive tomorrow. It has now just been 2 months, I think, after I finally reached that big milestone.
2 months, yeah. I mean, that's pretty good. I think that they used to do like half a year sometimes.
I was kind of upset because, so the thing is, when you reach 100,000 subscribers, you're not automatically getting that play button.
Yeah.
YouTube will evaluate, I don't know if with machine learning or with real people, every channel that reached that milestone. And when the channel was checked, you will get like a redemption code in order to order the play button with a separate tool they provide. This has been taking 6 weeks for me until this redemption code arrived. And now it has been manufactured actually in the US, and it's been shipped to me.
I thought they had like a cost down round with the play buttons, where it was like, okay, they had a new supplier from China that now makes the I guess more efficient to produce one, the non-framed version.
There was a video on the channel. I think it's called What's Inside.
Yeah. Sometimes pretty cringy content.
Yeah. On their channel, where they visited the kind of factory where they are making the play buttons, and at least mine has been shipped from the US. I think they only do the marking of the play buttons in the US, more or less like the blank for the play buttons. They are, I think, for sure made
mass in China. Produced at this point, yeah.
Because if you just take a look at how many channels are reaching 100,000 subscribers every day, this is just such a huge scale, which, yeah, it's just way cheaper in China.
Yeah. I think mine was actually shipped directly from China. All right. So, yeah, again, congratulations to that. That is a really big milestone. But we already covered that in one of the previous episodes.
Yes, we did.
Let's move on to news. With a correction from last episode on my side, I did an oopsie. I called Elegoo being the RepRap Pro, which they are not. That is Longer 3D. Quick backstory to RepRap Pro. That is actually the company name that Adrian Boyer originally had to sell the Fisher kits and some other printers and printer parts. Eventually, he was like, okay, I don't want this business anymore. He sold it to a company, I think, from China somewhere. And that apparently is Longer 3D. I mixed them up. I mixed up Elegoo and Longer 3D because they both like released pretty similar SLA printers or MSLA printers around the same time. So my brain was just like, okay, yeah, sure, this is those guys. But no, RepRap Pro, actually at RepRap Pro on Twitter, that is Longer 3D. They also make like a $250 MSLA printer. But yeah, not that is not Elegoo. Elegoo is not RepRap Pro.
Staying on the topic of resin printers, it's...
Here we go.
Here we go. Just again, a safety note.
Here we go, ranting again.
I don't really want to rant, but just make people aware of the... of the issues that might pop up.
Yeah, let's keep it short.
Yeah, sorry, my neck. So there has been a thread on Facebook this week in the Anycubic Photon printer owner user group, and a guy posted pictures of his arm where he really got like burn blisters on his arm after a bit of resin spilled on him, and he didn't clean it off right away because he cleaned the printer off at first. And then just at the next day, he had huge blisters on his arm. This was actually the first occasion where I have seen such a severe reaction to like 3D printing resin before. Yeah. There have definitely been other cases before, but this just tells me again, pay attention, wear goggles, wear a respirator, if possible, wear safety glasses and things like these. And if you spill resin somewhere on your body, wash it away right away. Wash it away right away, yeah.
There were some notes, I don't know if it was on that discussion or in some other place, that specifically said, do not use, like you mentioned, do not use warm water because that's going to open up your pores. Do not use solvent because that is actually going to wick the resin into your skin even more.
Yeah.
So read up on resin safety before you need to. Like read up on it before you actually spill stuff on yourself. But yeah, like you said, that there were some cases with people that work with epoxy resins and like other resins regularly that get skin rashes and allergic reactions and all sorts of other stuff because they work with, you know, making fiberglass molds or stuff like that and just get the stuff on themselves. That is not news. That's been around for forever, and epoxy resins are also, you know, sensitizing and they're dangerous in the same way. But this is like the first report where we've seen it with actual 3D printing resin. So folks, be careful. I actually did crop out the picture from our show notes here because it's kind of making me sick. It looks like it's right from Left 4 Dead. It ain't pretty.
Yeah.
Be safe, guys.
We try to link the article below, but I didn't figure out how I could get a link to a Facebook thread out of Facebook. Yeah. It's probably Facebook just me, but I wasn't able to do it.
Okay, let's move on to something that's more fun to discuss. Curvy Slicer, adding a real 3D, sorry, third dimension.
Yeah, so there was a post on Twitter, like I think yesterday or the day before yesterday.
It's called a tweet.
A tweet. Oh yeah, sorry.
I use a lingo,
which mentioned Curvy Slicer, which is, I think, a French slicer, which is currently developed at a French university, which is adding a real third dimension into 3D printing. So what we are usually doing, we are kind of doing a 2.5D printing. So we always print two-dimensional layers, and then after each layer, we rise our print head, the layer height, and then we continue printing again. What Curvy Slicer is actually doing, they slice the parts in a way that the layer thickness is varying over one layer. So the print head also starts to move in order to compensate that. And they want to reduce the stair step effect in that, with that method. They have a really interesting paper out there where you can take a look at how it really changes the looks and also the variation in the geometrical accuracy of 3D prints with this method. I think it's really interesting, but I think it's again what's the feature in Cura? Adaptive layer height. I think it's just again adaptive layer height, which is kind of only working with specific parts. So it's not a method which can be applied in general on all of the parts, making all of the parts look better and be more accurate. But what's your take on that?
Same, essentially. Non-planar slicing, as it's been called before, it's not a new thing. Like, there have been papers and trials, and I think ETH Zurich came out with that where I saw it the first time, 5-6 years ago. Because it is actually pretty obvious. If you want to print something that has a slanted top surface, well, why don't you move the nozzle along that slanted top surface, right? It seems so obvious. But as far as I know, I've never actually seen a software that is available that actually does it. Mm. It's always been research papers, academic, exercises. It's never been something that it could actually use. And like you mentioned, I think for that exact reason that it doesn't work for every model, and the algorithm for sure has its limits. What I'm looking here right now is Corvette shaped vehicle, where you can clearly see the layers bending and getting thinner towards the hood, and then where you have the windshield, they barely slope. I think that it's not perfectly planar on the windshield, but they slope up to reduce the stair steps. Yeah, it's gonna work for some models. It may actually work for many models and slightly improve them. It may just be like a checkbox where it's like, okay, yeah, like detect thin walls, where it's always active, and where it fits in, it can work well, but it's definitely not an end-all solution. Mm. What I'm thinking also here is, how is it going to work for bridges? Mm. That's going to be hard. Obviously, overhangs are going to change. Overhangs may actually improve because you could print them in a different way where, I don't know, we're going up a different slope.
And you're kind of limited, with the slope angle dependent on how your nozzle looks like, because your nozzle will always be perpendicular to your print bed. And if you're printing at an angle, you kind of... The nozzle is not perpendicular anymore to the printing direction, which could cause problems. I would really like to see something like that implemented in Cura or any other slicer where you can also do standard slicing, because I think it's a too niche application where a slicer that can do that would really pop out and be something you could use for every part. And people tend to stick with one specific slicer for all of their parts.
Yeah. I think I falsely attributed non-planar slicing to E3D's Patheo, or it's not E3D, it's a sub brand of E3D, but Patheo. I think I wrongly like thought that would have the feature, but it does not. Though I think that they're working on implementing it. And again, yeah, it's really about having it in a product. And I mean, the academic research is nice and all, and having methods that identify top layers that need to be curved is nice and all, but we actually got to see it in production, because I'm sure there's more to it than, okay, yeah, we figured out how to bend layers. Like that, there are practical implications to this as well.
Yeah, but it's cool. There hasn't been any real big new things on the slicer markets for the last couple of, well, last years.
What has Patheo been up to?
I have been testing one of the newer releases of Patheo a couple of weeks ago. I am thinking about doing diving into Patheo a little bit deeper again and to see where their new features are and how it compares to like Cura, Simplify 3D or Prusa Slicer. But just too much things going on at the moment. I really appreciate what they're doing, and I hope they're getting into the right direction. But at the point where they were releasing the first beta, which was more like an alpha, it was just not really usable for normal production.
It was a tech demo, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that is Curvy Slice. I mean, it's a slick name, but like it needs to be something that he can use.
Link to the tweet and also to the papers down in the description. I think they said that there will be a software release shortly in the future. We might get back to it when we try it out ourselves. But yeah, I think it's a niche application, just like adaptive layer height.
Yeah. Here's just one quick note that I'm seeing. Their work will be unveiled at SIGGRAPH on July 31st. So
that is the day after tomorrow.
Yeah. So maybe when you're listening this to this, you may be able to check out more details on that. What I'm really hoping is that it doesn't go down that route that many academic projects go down, which is, hey, we've secured the patent on this. Let's make a tech demo and sell off the patent as expensively as possible. I mean, we've seen enough of that already. So, right. That was Curvy Slicer. We are at 57 minutes. Let's do a topic of the week, shall we?
Yes. So you have chosen the one for this week.
I just wrote that down because it popped into my mind before we started here.
So yeah, tell us about it.
Where are we actually using 3D printing? Are we actually using 3D printing? Because that's something I think that comes up in comment section sometimes. Like, dude, are you actually printing stuff, or are you just like creating this weird wacky demo, you know, stuff, or printing more benches, or are you actually using 3D printing for real world applications? And I think I am. Are you?
I would like to do more in that direction, but yeah, from time to time I have some minutes off from normal work and I really use my 3D printer in order to mostly repair stuff, which is breaking normal injection molded parts.
Hey, well, why did you print yourself a new rotor?
I thought that this comment would pop up, but no, probably that's not going to work out. I hear that very often at work, at my normal work where I also do like constantly 3D printing. Why don't you print yourself a new one? Oh, come on, just shut up.
I mean, if you printed like it looks like it's relatively cheap magnets. It's not neodymium magnets or anything. So I'm thinking if you print yourself a cage out of a relatively high strength material and just embed neodymium magnets, couldn't you just make a replacement?
Yeah, I don't know how the temperatures are. I really thought about just gluing the remaining magnets back in there and see if it works.
Yeah, but then another one is going to pop off.
Yeah, that's the thing.
You'd have to replace the adhesive on all of them.
Yeah, I already ordered a new one. It should work out. But yeah, back to the topic. So what I usually use 3D printing for in a real practical case is for repairing things that break. So I recently did the video on the gearbox of the salad spinner I repaired. That's something really nice where just a small part in a product failed. You take the part, you kind of reverse engineer it, print it out, and have a working product back in action. And I think that's a great application. But there are also other applications. So when I do like lots of, well, my own testing machines, I do most of the part in 3D printing, or I 3D print most of the parts, just because I get from CAD design to a mostly functional part very quickly. And I don't have all of the tools that would be required to make them out of like, yeah, metal. So if you need to know some design rules, and you need to know which material to choose for a specific application, but also, yeah, functional parts can be printed with that.
Yeah. It's, you know, when you're saying, okay, I'm making testing jigs and new machines and all that, it's kind of like, it's that argument that's being brought up with CNCing and woodworking too. Like, you're just feeding the beast. Like, you're not actually creating anything from it. You're just making more tools to make more things, to make more tools for yourself. Like, obviously, something like what Matthias Wandel is doing with all his, you know, wooden machines, like his wooden bandsaw and the wooden belt grinder and all that. Like, yeah, he has those tools to make more tools. And I feel like it's, you can get into that rut if you... if you do 3D printing as well, you just print another printer, you print upgrades for your printer. And outside of that, you do kind of run out of ideas. But yeah, that's where the point comes in, that you actually need to be able to use some sort of CAD, that you need to design stuff for yourself. Because if you're just downloading things, it's kind of boring. And like you said, like I'm probably doing most of the same things as you are. Like, well, let me hold that into the camera here. These are guides for the window blinds that we typically have here in Germany that go on the outside of your windows. That, you know, shutters. No, there's not even a proper English name for them. These are like some guide pieces. They sit in like the bottom element of those and then glide down in like a rail. And one of the tabs broke because these things are 30 years old. So I printed a new one from PTG. Quick 10-minute design. Quick 3-hour print, and you know, these things are back in action. I probably wouldn't be able to find replacement parts that are this old, or you know, I'd have to buy an entire new blind. So stuff like this, or just simple parts really around the house, where it's okay, I need to mount that thing to that thing. I need to mount this shelf to the wall. Haha, yeah, that's a bit of a bigger project, but not the typical one. Really, the simple bits, I think, are where 3D printing is suited the best.
But maybe going back to your shelves, this is something where I think it's interesting to talk about. Where should you really apply it? So should you really use 3D printing at the moment for safety critical applications? Where,
I mean, yeah, people were commenting on that, yeah.
Because I imagine if I would have kids at home, I don't know if I would print like a shelf bracket thing, which is in a location where my kids could probably just be. Because if that thing fails, and just with some recent tests, I also had the problem again that some of the parts just were not as good as the rest of them because some random printing errors happened. Do you really want to be responsible for your design failing and then hurting somebody else? And this is, I think this is a critical topic to talk about, where some people might really oversee that because they print even safety critical parts that might work for a bit of time, but maybe just their selection of material was not good for having this part last for a couple of years and something like that. And your shelf bracket also goes into this direction, because if your shelves break down, and they could potentially hurt somebody.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, that's something that you have to keep in mind for sure. In my case, there is that argument to be made, like, you shouldn't be 3D printing this because, like I showed, there's a $3 alternative from IKEA that is going to be way stronger and way more durable in the long run because it's just, it's three sticks of wood. So, yeah, maybe printing shelves like that is not the most practical or the smartest thing, but they look cool and there's no other way to make them like that.
I don't argue there. They're really nice.
That's my point there. And also the way that they look, like, yeah, I could have, it's not the optimal design. Like, I'm not saying that. It's just the optimal design because it looks cool for me for this application. And they are plenty strong.
Yeah, definitely.
If anything fails, it's the wall.
But this is maybe something interesting. If we want, or well, if we in general, so the industry wants to use 3D printing in a more, in a way that you can really use it for products, quality control systems on printers, this is something where still a lot of work needs to be put in, because injection molding or normal machining or things like these, even though you don't have like a huge quality control system for your injection molded parts, but we have experience with that process for decades. There is usually a quality control process for, well, raw materials when you buy them and things like these. But 3D printing at the moment, it works most of the time, but there are still occasions where things just go wrong and you might not be able to spot them by just looking at your parts. So I think what we will be seeing more and more in the future are quality control systems directly working in the printer, just gathering some data, maybe just like we have seen it with E3D's tool changer. You have a print head that has a camera on it, and after each layer it just scans your print bed and looks for like extrusion errors and things like these. And this already goes into the direction where you could use a process like 3D printing for more safety critical applications.
We're just like, it doesn't have to be as complex as a camera. There's some stuff that I can't talk about right now, but there are systems that are way simpler than that that can improve how consistent and how reliable a 3D printer can be, and how much it can monitor about the process itself, because that's something that's really lacking. Like, all we know is the temperatures of the heated bed and the nozzle. That's really the only sensors that a 3D printer has. Maybe, it has a filament sensor that detects if there's filament in the thing or not, but that's really it. More sensors. Yes, more sensors is, I think, really critical. Filament diameter stuff.
That would be probably be too much and making like the normal hobbyist machines too expensive. But I would really be interested what, for example, simple things. Yeah. But if you, I would really be interested to know what, process monitoring systems, for example, Stratasys has implemented in their really big and usually expensive machines, because they have materials and processes that are certified for aerospace applications. And I know from my experience, from my normal work, that if you want to get a part into an airplane, you need to do kind of a lot of certification stuff, which involves quality assurance. And I would be really interested to see if what kind of parameters they are monitoring and they are storing and they're analyzing during the prints of those parts.
I'm guessing with Stratasys and the more professional machines, it's also that they're controlling the ecosystem. They're controlling what replacement parts are being put in. They're controlling the materials, so they can make those to spec and monitor those during production. That would be interesting, but we probably don't have anyone that is going to tear apart a modern Stratasys machine for us or provide one that just shows up at the doorstep that we can dig into. Though, like, if anyone out there listening has one of those that they want to like have disseminated, this integrated, this, you know, taken apart. Let's go with that. Hit us up. I think that would be really interesting to look into.
But, well, we were starting, what are applications for 3D printing at the moment? Where should it be used for? And one really big thing I see also, like, where companies can benefit from 3D printing, from FDM 3D printing at the moment, is prototyping.
That's where it's coming from, right?
That's where it's coming from. It's
literally rapid prototyping.
Yeah, it's rapid prototyping. Many engineers at the moment, they are just doing their designs in CAD. Often they don't really have an idea how big their part will really be in the end. So I also at the moment often already see the benefit by just printing out a part and putting it into the hands of a designer and asking him, do you really want to do that? Do you really think that could be manufactured on a normal like CNC machine? Or you use the prototypes to pre-assemble your assemblies and see if everything's working. If it's assemblable, take it into your hands, see if this will be really manufacturable. Can you do changes to make it more efficient and things like these? And in this direction, 3D printing is so affordable and so cheap that I really think it should be used way more often. And there are, well, closed ecosystems like the Ultimaker or even the Prusa printers at the moment, where you buy their materials, where you buy their machines, where you buy or where you use their slicers, and everything just works without a lot of hassle. And even people that haven't been using 3D printing a lot, they can just use it.
Yeah, I mean, with those systems, you don't have to use the materials, but you have that option. You have that option of using stuff that they guarantee will click together.
Yeah,
and yeah, like you mentioned, that assembly fallacy that we often see is like, hey, you know, this looks really cool in CAD. Look how well this all fits together. Mm-hmm. And then you have the parts in your hand. Mm-hmm. You try to put them together, and there's no way to actually assemble them into the positions that you want them to be in. I've seen that before, and it's hilarious, but also kind of sad if you've invested in tooling or in, at that point it's pretty late in the process. But if you've got prototypes that were machined for hundreds of euros, and then you can't actually assemble them, yeah. But that's professional use. Where can a typical, you know, mom and dad or other, where can a family actually use a 3D printer in their daily life?
Lithophanes.
Okay.
I have never been printing. I honestly never printed any lithophanes, but I heard that they are kind of nice, that people tend to print them out instead of like getting real pictures developed on like film strips or something like that. Yeah, it's not the application I would use it for, but yeah, home appliances, decor items and things like these, there is an application. It's not the most efficient way, but yeah, 3D printing is still a hobby. You shouldn't always ask, is it the best idea to print something out if there is something on the market which is cheaper? It's a hobby. You do that because you like to do it. So yeah, I think even printing decor things and stuff like that, if people are happy doing that, I think it's a good application for 3D printing.
Yeah. Like I said, it's a hobby, and I think many companies are overselling machines to consumers, and they've been for a while where it's like, oh, you can do all these things. But actually, you won't, because you're going to be lazy, or you're not going to have the perfect matching part, or, you know, it's not going to be good for that application. It's, yeah, really, if you have something that you can design yourself, that's going to be great. I kind of want to compare it to woodworking, because, I mean, a lot of people, probably more people are into woodworking than they are into 3D printing, though. Yeah. I don't know, 3D printing is kind of easier to get into at this point. But if you have like a woodworking shop, like what do you actually make with that? I just watched, I like to make stuff. What's his name? Three easy bathroom projects, three woodworking projects. And yeah, you can do those, but you could also just buy the same things. Like, okay, he's making a soap tray, shelf bracket, and what was the other one? A towel hanger. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you I'm getting hungry. I'm hoping you can hear that on mic.
Bob.
And those are things where you're like, okay, yeah, you know, you could buy those things, right? Yeah. You don't have to make them.
No.
Just go out there and buy probably something that is very, very similar. You make things because you want to make things.
Yeah.
And that's something that's come up in yesterday's stream where somebody was asking, hey, what my daughter's asking me, like, what's the definition, your definition of what a maker is? And I was like, I mean, you create things, right? You create for the sake of creating, because most things you could just buy. Mm. And if you fall into that area where it's fun for you to create something that's your own, that's not just a store-bought item, then yeah, that's the use cases that you're going to find that 3D printing makes sense. We're getting all philosophical here.
Well, it's a philosophical topic. Yeah, we often see 3D printing more in the direction of mechanical parts and really functional parts, but it also has a stand in arts.
For sure.
Yeah, it does not only, well, you don't necessarily need to know how to sculpt something on your PC and then print it out to have a physical representation of the art you did on the computer. But there are also different applications you can use 3D printing for to create art. Last podcast, we talked about David Chory.
Yeah.
And the like dresses he makes with 3D printing. And these are things you kind of only can make with 3D printing. And that's a really cool application.
Yeah. So as usual, the art and engineering, or the A in STEAM, it does matter. Does matter a lot, because I think the transition is pretty, pretty fluid. Cool. So we didn't really answer the question, but, I think we had some good stuff to talk about here. Anyways, should we answer some questions that came from the community?
Yes, we do.
Let's do a rapid fire round here. Hoping we're not wearing listeners out too much this time. TS3D Prince is asking, have you seen the Matter Hackers or the BASF UltraFuse 316L metal 3D printing filament? Really excited for it. Want to 3D print a turbocharger for a 49cc gas engine?
Yes, I have seen it. So the UltraFuse BASF UltraFuse filament, that is a 3D printing filament that is infused with, I think, 70 or 80% by weight metal powder. So you can use it in a standard 3D printer, print out a part, but that doesn't in the end give you a metal part, because this is a green part for a sintering process. So there are additional steps involved in order to get a real metal part out of your 3D print if you're using this material, and people should be aware of that. It's the same thing if you take a look at desktop metal. It's the same thing if you take a look at Markforged.
Yeah.
You always 3D print a green part, which is like a metal part that is held together by some polymers. Then you take this green part, put it into an oven where more or less the polymer is burned out. During this process, your part shrinks like by almost 20%. So it's a really interesting and involving project process. Then you take this now called brown part and then put it into a sintering oven. And the sintering oven really heats up the part to almost its melting point, where the small metal powder parts are then really melting together, sintering together, to give you a part in the end that has a density between like 90 to 100%.
Yeah, so it's all that post-processing that you need to add. Is the finished part with like the UltraFuse stuff, is it actually a sintered sponge, or is it more like an actual solid part?
I think it really depends on the quality also of your green part. So how dense are you, have you been able to 3D print your part in the first place?
Right.
In the end, it's still more a sintered part than a solid part. As I said, you are in a density region between like 90 or 95 to 100%. There are still a lot of pores in the material. The strength of these 3D printed and sintered parts is not on par with if you take bar material, but it is almost as good. But you still have issues with different properties in printing directions and all of the things which are involved in that. But the final properties are better than your normal 3D printed plastic parts.
Oh, for sure, because it is metal.
Yeah, right? There is an application for this process, but everybody needs to be aware that there is a lot of equipment necessary in order to get from your 3D printed part to the real metal part in the end.
Yeah, I guess burning out the polymer base I could do in my pyrolysis oven, which goes up to 500 degrees Celsius, but the actual sintering, probably not.
Nah. And, well, the it's called, I think, debindering process is something, it always depends on which material you use. I think desktop metal, they are using a solvent bath where you put your part into a solvent bath where the polymer is just, well,
washed out.
There are other catalytic debindering processes where your part is, I think, in something like it's not a hydrogen atmosphere. It's a, it's a ammonia, I think an ammonia atmosphere thing at some raised temperatures where the polymer chains are broken down slowly. So it's not only just burning out. I think you can't do it in your pyrolysis oven.
Okay. It's not that I would, but I still want to use it for food.
Yeah.
And what do you think about 3D printing a turbocharger for a pretty small gas engine? Is that something that's actually practical, or is that something that should rather be done on a multi-axis CNC mill?
It could be done. Probably the 316L, the stainless steel, isn't that happy at the raised temperatures, but there are currently also the manufacturers of the material, they are currently also working on other materials that can be 3D printed besides stainless steel. So, for example, the super alloys, the nickel base alloys like Inconel and things. We might be seeing filaments in the future which are Inconel based, which could handle like rocket engine temperatures.
Oh, I don't even want to think about the prices per spool of that stuff. I mean, what I'm thinking with a turbocharger is because that thing is going to be spinning pretty fast. Yeah. That's going to be a real pain to balance.
So,
because it is a combination of just FDM, where you get all the issues with FDM, then you wash out the binder, and then you sinter it, which again probably warps the part slightly. So I don't see how you're going to get a balanced turbocharger fan out of that process.
So in my opinion, this process will still involve like normal machining. So the real benefit from that technology is, in my opinion, as with also metal 3D printing, so like direct metal laser sintering, where you can print things which would not have been able to manufacture in a conventional way. So if you want to do a turbocharger, you probably need to turn it down to this tight tolerances. You probably would need to balance it in the end. You would probably need to add threads in the end. So it's just an additional process in the process chain to get another like raw part. So it's kind of comparable. It's kind of comparable to a
casting process, right?
Yeah, a cast blank. Yeah.
All right, so probably not going to see 3D printed turbochargers
I would be happy to see it.
It sounds like a cool project, but it sounds like a really involved project very uncertain outcome. All right, Nathaniel is asking, what if the slicer had the ability to print outer walls and inner walls at different fan settings? Could this produce great-looking, strong parts?
So I think the background behind this question was that I have been telling you guys about that I have that I'm currently doing a video on what's the influence on strength with different fan settings. And I said that you can hugely increase the strength of your 3D prints if you decrease the fan setting, but you will lose details on your parts because overhangs will not be printed that pretty anymore. So he is now asking about the possibility to change the fan setting depending on the kind of feature you're printing at the moment. And this is something which is actually already possible. So,
oh, wow. What slicer does that?
You can definitely do it in Simplify 3D because Simplify 3D lets you use scripts. So one script right. could be like a batch replace in the sense that Simplify 3D gives comments in your decode which feature it is currently printing, and you could just replace the comment where it says outer or inner wall
with start outer shell in the outer shell something like that,
with different fan setting commands. And you could then also just do it manually if you use any text editor and just replace parts of the G-code with that. Yeah, so that would be possible. Also, Pathio is something which will in the future be really, really strong in this direction because they have this scripting engine in the background which is specifically designed to do things like this, to give you really more, way more possibilities in order to change some specific things in the G-code in the end. So it would be possible at the moment. It's a really nice idea. I need to think about that. But I think one problem would always be that you need to take into consideration that also your fan has kind of a lag. So by...
That's fast enough. I mean, that's like 1 or 2 seconds at most.
Maybe. You could add pauses before that happens, so you spin up the fan or spin down the fan and then continue printing. I think it's an interesting idea. Maybe it's really worth looking into that if that would help.
I'm thinking about like what are the implications when it comes to just not printing the entire layer at the same setting, because that's always kind of an issue if you change print settings or print speeds or all those things during a layer. I'm thinking like, okay, is this part now going to cool less consistently and you're going to see more warp because it's not printed at the same like fan speed at the entire time, or are we going to see I don't know, the inner walls warping away from the outer walls? I don't know, stuff like that may happen, but experience can show. And like you said, Simplify 3D has scriptings. Cura also has a find and replace engine, which is pretty janky right now. It's like you can't actually store settings in there, but that also does it. And I think it also has comments in there. And yeah, the new Prusa slicer has also included way more script positions than before, but I don't think it's that granular. Mm.
But if you want to try it out, just use Notepad++ or any other text editor.
Yeah.
And yeah, just replace these comments tells in the G-code which feature it's currently printing and see if that changes anything. Would be interested to hear that.
Absolutely. And the last one for today is from Garrett Klein. Have either of you guys looked at using the SolidWorks Maker license?
No, because I have never used SolidWorks in the past.
No, because I've never heard of it before. So yeah, I did use SolidWorks during university, simply because, well, everyone, and including the professors, were using SolidWorks, and our lessons were based on SolidWorks, because SolidWorks had it's not the student license, it's like the very smallest license of SolidWorks that you could get that was severely feature limited. Like there wasn't even an STL export in there, so you couldn't use it for 3D printing, which was fantastic. So yeah, I did use SolidWorks quite a bit. I know the software, and I mean, if you know one CAD tool, like you know them all. They're all pretty much the same. It's the same features. It's the same sketches. Like you just press different buttons, and in the end, the result is the same thing. And I did quickly look into the SolidWorks Maker license, what that actually is. So it it's based on the SOLIDWORKS Community Access Initiative, I guess, that there are a few conflicting bits of information here. So if you look at what SOLIDWORKS is actually offering, it's a license for makerspaces, essentially, in Fab Labs, where they may have a workstation there that people can use, and they put SOLIDWORKS on there, and they get a SOLIDWORKS Professional or Premium, I think it's called, a SOLIDWORKS Premium license for that. Members of that makerspace can then use. And the Premium license, I think, has most of the stuff in there that you need, including simulation and all that. Pretty good simulation that runs locally on your computer, which I actually love. But if you actually... So that's just for makerspaces. That is not something that you can use as an individual. Now, if you look at what the Community Access Initiative is, apparently that includes manufacturers, makers, military, and sponsored organizations. So I guess you can use it for private and academic purpose. And there are on my deals, there's like the guide to use code 918 maker and the download links and all that. So I guess you can use it somewhat legally, though I don't think SOLIDWORKS cares that much anyways, unless you're a big organization. And yeah, if it's SOLIDWORKS Premium, like it's a really nice tool, actually. There is that one limitation that it is only for personal use. So I can't use it. You can't really use it because it's always like business use, I guess.
Yeah.
Because we do make money off of using these tools and showing the tools. So I'm probably never going to use it. But yeah, if you like SOLIDWORKS, again, it's a pretty good tool. I'd say it's probably better than Fusion 360 even. if you want to use SOLIDWORKS, that may be something to look into.
Yeah.
It's 1 year licenses, as far as I know.
But
so,
I think also for Fusion 360, the license you are granted is usually
yes.
for 1 year. And you, I can't 100% remember, but I think after 1 year, even in Fusion 360, a window pops up where you need to renew your license and state again that you are still not a company which has more revenue than $100,000.
Yeah. I don't actually remember ever doing that, but
I think I remember doing that in the past, but not 100% sure.
Yeah, I'm also not sure if I've used Fusion for a full year now. But yeah, it's the same for SOLIDWORKS. It's a 1 year license, and I know from the free student versions from SOLIDWORKS, it actually did stop working after a year.
Mm.
So I'm thinking it's the same for the SOLIDWORKS Maker license, though. Well, experience will have to tell. If you want to try it out, it's for sure a nice move from them.
Yeah,
because we've been seeing a lot of free CAD tools these days, and SOLIDWORKS is. Yeah, it's usually a pretty expensive tool. Like, I've looked into licensing costs if you buy the premium, the fully featured version, and it's like 80,000 euros for one license, and then next year the new version comes out and you have to upgrade. So, yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah, all right. And I think that's it with the questions for today.
That's it with the episode for today.
Oh, yes.
We did it.
Yeah. So, yeah. I guess thanks for watching, everyone. If you have any comments or questions for upcoming episodes, just put them down into the description or tweet us at the Melt Zone. Yeah?
Yeah.
You wanted to say something?
People don't edit our descriptions, hopefully.
Oh, yeah.
Drop them in the comments.
Drop them in the comments. It's already, yeah. The head is mushing up
early,
more
retired.
And more. Thanks for watching. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your time, Tom. And
yeah, thanks for your time, Stefan.
I guess I see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I see you then.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.